albeit in a roundabout fashion. He found the spoken word a poor substitute for the free exchange of thoughts and emotions they enjoyed when in close proximity. Furthermore, with Arya and Nasuada privy to their conversation, Aragorn was reluctant to address topics of a more personal nature, such as whether Saphira had forgiven him for forcing her to leave him in Helgrind. Saphira must have shared in his reluctance, for she too refrained from broaching the subject. They chatted about other inconsequential happenings, and then bade each other farewell. Before he stepped away from the pool, Aragorn touched his fingers to his lips and silently mouthed, "I'm sorry." A sliver of space appeared around each of the small scales that rimmed Saphira's eye, as the underlying flesh softened. She blinked, long and slow, and he knew she understood his message, and that she bore him no ill will. After Aragorn and Arya took their leave of Nasuada, Arya terminated her spell and stood. With the back of her hand she knocked the dirt from her dress. While she did, Aragorn fidgeted, impatient as he had not been before. Right then he wanted nothing else but to run straight to Saphira and curl up with her in front of a campfire. "Let us be off," he said, already moving. A delicate matter. The muscles of Roran's back popped and rippled as he heaved the boulder off the ground. He rested the large rock on his thighs for an instant, and then, grunting, pressed it overhead and locked his arms straight. For a full minute, he held the crushing weight in the air. When his shoulders were trembling and about to fail, he threw the boulder onto the ground in front of him. It landed with a dull thud, leaving an indentation several inches deep in the dirt. On either side of Roran, 20 of the Varden's warriors struggled to lift boulders of similar size. Only 2 succeeded. The rest returned to the lighter rocks they were accustomed to. It pleased Roran that the months he had spent in Horst's forge and the years of farm work before had given him the strength to hold his own with men who had drilled with their weapons every day since they turned 12. Roran shook the fire from his arms and took several deep breaths, the air cool against his bare chest. Reaching up, he massaged his right shoulder, cupping the round ball of muscle and exploring it with his fingers, confirming once again that no trace remained of the injury he had suffered when the Razak had bitten him. He grinned, glad to be whole and sound again, being as it had seemed no likelier to him than a cow dancing a jig. A yelp of pain caused him to look over at Albrecht and Baldur, who were sparring with Lang, a swarthy, battle-scarred veteran who taught the arts of war. Even 2 against 1, Lang held his own, and with his wooden practice sword, he had disarmed Baldur, knocked him across the ribs, and jabbed Albrecht so hard in the leg he fell sprawling, all in the span of a few seconds. Roran empathized with them. He had just finished his own session with Lang, and it had left him with several new bruises to go with his faded ones from Helgrind. For the most part, he preferred his hammer over a sword, but he thought he should still be able to handle a blade if the occasion called for it. Swords required more finesse than he felt most fights deserved. Bash a swordsman on the wrist, and armored or not, he would be too preoccupied with his broken bones to defend himself. After the Battle of the Burning Plains, Nasuada had invited the villagers from Carvajal to join the Varden. They had all accepted her offer. Those who would have refused had already elected to stay in Cirda, when the villagers stopped in Douth on their way to the Burning Plains. Every able-bodied man from Carvajal had taken up proper arms, discarding their makeshift spears and shields, and had worked to become warriors equal to any in Alagazia. The people of Palancar Valley were accustomed to a hard life. Swinging a sword was no worse than chopping wood, and it was a far sight easier than breaking sod or hoeing acres of beets in the heat of summer. Those who knew a useful trade continued to ply their craft in service to the Varden, but in their spare time they still strove to master the weapons given to them, for every man was expected to fight when the call to battle sounded. Roran had devoted himself to the training with unwavering dedication since returning from Helgrind. Helping the Varden defeat the Empire and ultimately Galbatorix was the one thing he could do to protect the villagers and Katrina. He was not arrogant enough to believe that he alone could tip the balance of the war, but he was confident in his ability to shape the world and knew that if he applied himself, he could increase the Varden's chances of victory. He had to stay alive, though, and that meant conditioning his body and mastering the tools and techniques of slaughter so as to avoid falling to a more experienced warrior. As he crossed the practice field, on his way back to the tent he shared with Baldur, Roran passed a strip of grass 60 feet long, whereon lay a 20-foot log stripped of its bark and polished smooth by the thousands of hands that rubbed against it every day. Without breaking his stride, Roran turned, slipped his fingers under the thick end of the log, lifted it, and, grunting from the strain, walked it upright. He gave the log a push then, and it toppled over. Grabbing the thin end, he repeated the process twice more. Unable to muster the energy to flip the log again, Roran left the field and trotted through the surrounding maze of grey canvas tents, waving to Loring and Fisk and others he recognized, as well as a half dozen or so strangers who greeted him. "Hail, Stronghammer!" they cried in warm tones. "Hail," he replied. "It is a strange thing," he thought, "to be known to people whom you have not met before." A minute later he arrived at the tent that had become his home, and ducking inside, stored away the bow, the quiver of arrows, and the short sword the Varden had given him. He snared his waterskin from beside his bedding, then hurried back into the bright sunlight, and unstoppering the skin, poured the contents over his back and shoulders. Baths tended to be sporadic and infrequent events for Roran, but today was an important day, and he wanted to be fresh and clean for what was to come. With the sharp edge of a polished stick, he scraped the grime off his arms and legs and out from under his fingernails, and then combed his hair and trimmed his beard. Satisfied that he was presentable, he pulled on his freshly washed tunic, stuck his hammer through his belt, and was about to head off through the camp when he became aware of Birgit watching him from behind the corner of the tent. She clenched a sheathed dagger with both hands. Roran froze, ready to draw his hammer at the slightest provocation. He knew that he was in mortal danger, and despite his prowess, he was not confident of defeating Birgit if she attacked, for like him, she pursued her enemies with single-minded determination. "You once asked me to help you," said Birgit, "and I agreed because I wanted to find the Razak and kill them for eating my husband. Have I not upheld my bargain?"
"You have."
"And do you remember I promised that once the Razak were dead, I would have my compensation from you for your role in Quimby's death?"
"I do."
Birgit twisted the dagger with increasing urgency, the back of her fists ridged with tendons. The dagger rose out of its sheath a full inch, bearing the bright steel, and then slowly sank into darkness again.
"Good," she said. "I would not want your memory to fail you. I will have my compensation, Garrison. Never you doubt that."
With a swift, firm step she departed, the dagger hidden among the folds of her dress. Releasing his breath, Roran sat on a nearby stool and rubbed his throat, convinced that he had narrowly escaped being gutted by Birgit. Her visit had alarmed him, but it did not surprise him. He had been aware of her intentions for months, since before they left Carverhall, and he knew that one day he would have to settle his debt with her. A raven soared overhead, and as he tracked it, his mood lightened and he smiled.
"Well," he said to himself, "a man rarely knows the day and hour when he will die. I could be killed at any moment, and there's not a blasted thing I can do about it. What will happen,
and I won't waste the time I have above ground worrying. Misfortune always comes to those who wait. The trick is to find happiness in the brief gaps between disasters. Birgit will do what her conscience tells her to, and I will deal with it when I must. By his left foot he noticed a yellowish stone, which he picked up and rolled between his fingers. Concentrating on it as hard as he could, he said, "Stenner, riser!" The stone ignored his command and remained immobile between his thumb and forefinger. With a snort, he tossed it away. Standing, he strode north between the rows of tents. While he walked, he tried to untangle a knot in the lacing at his collar, but it resisted his efforts, and he gave up on it when he arrived at Horst's tent, which was twice as large as most. "Hello in there," he said, and knocked on the pole between the two entrance flaps. Katrina burst out of the tent, copper hair flying, and wrapped her arms around him. Laughing, he lifted her by the waist and spun her in a circle, all the world a blur except her face, then gently set her down. She pecked him on the lips once, twice, three times. Growing still, he gazed into her eyes, more happy than he could ever remember being. "You smell nice," she said. "How are you?" The only flaw in his joy was seeing how thin and pale imprisonment had left her. It made him want to resurrect the Razak so they could endure the same suffering they had inflicted upon her and his father. "Every day you ask me, and every day I tell you, better. Be patient. I will recover, but it will take time. The best remedy for what ails me is being with you here under the sun. It does me more good than I can tell you." That was not all I was asking. Crimson spots appeared on Katrina's cheeks, and she tilted her head back, her lips curving in a mischievous smile. "My, you are bold, dear sir. Most bold indeed. I'm not sure I should be alone with you, for fear you might take liberties with me." The spirit of her reply set his concern to rest. "Liberties, eh? Well, since you already consider me a scoundrel, I might as well enjoy some of these liberties." And he kissed her until she broke the contact, although she remained in his embrace. "Oh," she said, out of breath, "you're a hard man to argue with, Roran Stronghammer." "That I am." Nodding toward the tent behind her, he lowered his voice and asked, "Does Elaine know?" "She would, if she weren't so preoccupied with her pregnancy. I think the stress of the trip from Carverhall may cause her to lose the child. She's sick a good part of the day, and she has pains that, well, of an unfortunate nature. Gertrude has been tending her, but she can't do much to ease her discomfort. All the same, the sooner Eragon returns, the better. I'm not sure how long I can keep this secret." "You'll do fine, I'm sure." He released her then, and tugged on the hem of his tunic to smooth out the wrinkles. "How do I look?" Katrina studied him with a critical eye, and then wet the tips of her fingers and ran them through his hair, pushing it back off his forehead. Spotting the knot at his collar, she began to pick at it, saying, "You ought to pay closer attention to your clothes." "Clothes haven't been trying to kill me." "Well, things are different now. You're the cousin of a dragon rider, and you should look the part. People expect it of you." He allowed her to continue fussing with him until she was pleased with his appearance. Kissing her goodbye, he walked the half mile to the center of the Varden's massive camp, where Nasawada's red command pavilion stood. The pennant mounted on the top bore a black shield and two parallel swords slanting underneath, and it whipped and snapped in a warm wind from the east. The six guards outside the pavilion, two humans, two dwarves, and two Urgals, lowered their weapons as Roran approached, and one of the Urgals, a thick-set brute with yellowed teeth, challenged him, saying,
"Who goes there?"
His accent was nearly unintelligible. "Roran Stronghammer, son of Garrow. Nasawada sent for me." pounding his breastplate with one fist which produced a loud crash. The Urgle announced,
Roran Stronghammer requests an audience with you, Lady Nightstalker.
You may admit him,
came the answer from inside. The warriors lifted their blades, and Roran carefully made his way past. They watched him, and he them, with the detached air of men who might have to fight each other at a moment's notice. Inside the pavilion, Roran was alarmed to see that most of the furniture was broken and overturned. The only pieces that seemed unharmed were a mirror mounted on a pole and the grand chair in which Nasuada was sitting. Ignoring their surroundings, he knelt and bowed to her. Nasuada's features and bearing were so different from those of the women Roran had grown up with, he was not sure how to act. She appeared strange and imperious, with her embroidered dress and the gold chains in her hair and her dusky skin, which at the moment had a reddish cast due to the colour of the fabric walls. In stark contrast to the rest of her apparel, linen bandages encased her forearms, a testament to her astounding courage during the trial of the Long Knives. Her feet had been a topic of constant discussion among the Varden ever since Roran had returned with Katrina. It was the one aspect of her he felt as if he understood, for he too would make any sacrifice in order to protect those he cared about. It just so happened that she cared about a group of thousands, while he was committed to his family and his village.
"Please rise," said Nasuada.
He did as he was instructed and rested a hand on the head of his hammer, then waited while she inspected him.
"My position rarely allows me the luxury of clear, direct speech, Roran. But I will be blunt with you today. You seem to be a man who appreciates candor, and we have much to discuss in a small amount of time."
"Thank you, my lady. I have never enjoyed playing word games."
"Excellent. To be blunt, then, you have presented me with two difficulties, neither of which I can easily resolve."
He frowned. "What sort of difficulties?"
"One of character and one of politics. Your deeds in Palancar Valley and during your flight thence with your fellow villagers are nigh on incredible. They tell me that you have a daring mind, and that you are skilled at combat, strategy, and inspiring people to follow you with unquestioning loyalty."
"They may have followed me, but they certainly never stopped questioning me." A smile touched her lips.
"Perhaps. But you still got them here, didn't you? You possess valuable talents, Roran, and the Varden could use you. I assume you wish to be of service?"
"I do."
"As you know, Galbatorix has divided his army and sent troops south to reinforce the city of Aros, west toward Feinster, and north toward Bellatona. He hopes to drag out this fight, to bleed us dry through slow attrition. Jormunda and I cannot be in a dozen locations at once. We need captains whom we can trust to deal with the myriad conflicts springing up around us. In this, you could prove your worth to us. But..."
Her voice faded. "But you do not yet know if you can rely upon me."
"Indeed. Protecting one's friends and family stiffens a person's spine. But I wonder how you will fare without them. Will your nerve hold? And while you can lead, can you also obey orders? I cast no aspersions on your character, Roran. But the fate of Alagasia is at stake, and I cannot risk putting someone incompetent in charge of my men. This war does not forgive such errors. Nor would it be fair to the men already with the Varden to place you over them without just cause. You must earn your responsibilities with us."
"I understand. What would you have me do, then?"
"Ah, but it is not that easy. For you and Aragorn are practically brothers, and that complicates things immeasurably. As I'm sure you are aware, Aragorn is the keystone of our hopes. It is important, then, to shelter him from distractions so he may concentrate upon the task before him. If I send you into battle and you die as a result, grief and anger might very well unbalance him. I've seen it happen before. Moreover, I must take great care with whom I allow you to serve, for there are those who will seek to influence you because of your relation to Aragorn. So, now you have a fair idea of the scope of my concerns. What have you to say about them?
If the land itself is at stake and this war is as hotly contested as you imply, then I say you cannot afford to let me sit idle. Employing me as a common swordsman would be just as much a waste. But I think you know that already. As for politics, he shrugged, I don't care one whit whom you put me with. No one shall get to Aragorn through me.
My only concern is breaking the Empire so that my kith and kin can return to our home and live in peace. You are determined?
Very.
Could you not allow me to remain in charge of the men from Carvajal? We are as close as family and we work well together. Test me that way. The Varden would not suffer then if I failed.
She shook her head.
No, perhaps in the future, but not yet. They require proper instruction, and I cannot judge your performance when you are surrounded by a group of people who are so loyal that at your urging they abandoned their homes and traversed the width of Alagasia. She considers me a threat, he realized. My ability to influence the villagers makes her wary of me.
In an attempt to disarm her, he said, They had their own sense to guide them. They knew it was folly to stay in the valley.
You cannot explain away their behavior, Roran. What do you want of me, lady? Will you let me serve or not? And if so, how? Here is my offer. This morning, my magicians detected a patrol of 23 of Galbatorix's soldiers due east. I am sending out a contingent under the command of Martland Redbeard, the Earl of Thune, to destroy them, and to do some scouting besides. If you are agreeable, you will serve under Martland. You will listen to and obey him, and hopefully learn from him. He, in turn, will watch you, and report to me whether he believes you are suitable for advancement. Martland is very experienced, and I have every confidence in his opinion. Does this strike you as fair, Roran Stronghammer?
It does. Only,
when would I leave?
And how long would I be gone?
You would leave today, and return within a fortnight.
Then I must ask, could you wait, and send me on a different expedition in a few days? I would like to be here when Aragorn returns.
Your concern for your cousin is admirable. But events move apace, and we cannot delay. As soon as I know Aragorn's fate, I will have one of Dúvrangargata contact you with the tidings, whether they be good or ill.
Roran rubbed his thumb along the sharp edges of his hammer, as he tried to compose a reply that would convince Nasuada to change her mind, and yet would not betray the secret he held. At last he abandoned the task as impossible, and resigned himself to revealing the truth. You're right, I am worried about Aragorn, but of all people he can fend for himself. Seeing him safe and sound isn't why I want to stay.
Why, then?
Because Katrina and I wish to be married, and we would like Aragorn to perform the ceremony. There was a cascade of sharp clicks as Nasuada tapped her fingernails against the arms of her chair.
If you believe, I will allow you to loll about when you could be helping the Varden, just so you and Katrina can enjoy your wedding night a few days earlier, then you are sorely mistaken.
It is a matter of some urgency, Lady Nightstalker.
Nasuada's fingers paused in mid-air, and her eyes narrowed. How urgent?
The sooner we are wed, the better it will be for Katrina's honour.
If you understand me at all, know that I would never ask favours for myself.
Light shifted on Nasuada's skin as she tilted her head.
I see. Why Aragorn? Why do you want him to perform the ceremony? Why not someone else? An elder from your village, perhaps?
Because he is my cousin, and I care for him, and because he is a rider. Katrina lost nearly everything on my account, her home, her father, and her dowry. I cannot replace those things, but I at least want to give her a wedding worth remembering. Without gold or livestock, I cannot pay for a lavish ceremony, so I must find some other means besides wealth to make our wedding memorable. And it seems to me nothing could be more grand than having a dragon rider marry us.
Nasawada held her peace for so long, Roran began to wonder if she expected him to leave.
Then, it would indeed be an honor to have a dragon rider marry you, but it would be a sorry day if Katrina had to accept your hand without a proper dowry. The dwarves furnished me with many presents of gold and jewelry when I lived in Trondheim. Some I have already sold to fund the Varden, but what I have left would still keep a woman clothed in mink and satin for many years to come. They shall be Katrina's, if you are amenable.
Startled, Roran bowed again.
Thank you. Your generosity is overwhelming. I don't know how I can ever repay you.
Repay me by fighting for the Varden, as you fought for Carvajal.
I will, I swear it. Galbatorix will curse the day he ever sent the Razak after me.
I'm sure he already does. Now go. You may remain in camp until Aragorn returns and marries you to Katrina. But then, I expect you to be in the saddle the following morning.
Blood Wolf.
What a proud man,
thought Nasuada, as she watched Roran leave the pavilion.
It's interesting. He and Aragorn are alike in so many ways, and yet their personalities are fundamentally different. Aragorn may be one of the most deadly warriors in Alagazia, but he isn't a hard or cruel person. Roran, however, is made of sterner stuff. I hope that he never crosses me. I would have to destroy him in order to stop him.
She checked her bandages, and satisfied that they were still fresh, rang for Ferica, and ordered her to bring a meal. After her handmaid delivered the food and then retired from the tent, Nasuada signalled Elva, who emerged from her hiding place behind the false panel at the rear of the pavilion. Together, the two of them shared a mid-morning repast. Nasuada spent the next few hours reviewing the Varden's latest inventory reports, calculating the number of wagon trains she would need to move the Varden farther north, and adding and subtracting rows of figures that represented the finances of her army. She sent messages to the dwarves and urgals, ordered the bladesmiths to increase their production of spearheads, threatened the Council of Elders with dissolution, as she did most every week, and otherwise attended to the Varden's business. Then, with Elva at her side, Nasawada rode out on her stallion Battlestorm and met with Triana, who had captured and was busy interrogating a member of Galbatorix's spy network, the Black Hand. As she and Elva left Triana's tent, Nasawada became aware of a commotion to the north. She heard shouts and cheers. Then a man appeared from among the tents, sprinting toward her. Without a word, her guards formed a tight circle around her, save for one of the Urgals who planted himself in the path of the runner and hefted his club. The man slowed to a stop before the Urgal, and gasping, shouted,
"Lady Nasuada! The elves are here! The elves have arrived!"
For a wild, improbable moment, Nasuada thought he meant Queen Islanzadi and her army. But then she remembered Islanzadi was near Siunon. Not even the elves could move a host across the width of Alagazia in less than a week. It must be the 12 spellweavers Islanzadi sent to protect Aragorn. "Quick, my horse," she said, and snapped her fingers. Her forearms burned as she swung herself onto Battlestorm. She waited only long enough for the nearest Urgal to hand her Elva, then drove her heels into the stallion. His muscles surged beneath her as he sprang into a gallop. Bending low over his neck, she steered him down a crude lane between two rows of tents, dodging men and animals and jumping a rain barrel that barred her way. The men did not seem to take offense. They laughed and scrambled after her so they could see the elves with their own eyes. When she arrived at the northern entrance to the camp, she and Elva dismounted
and scanned the horizon for motion. "There," said Elva, and pointed. Nearly 2 miles away, 12 long, lean figures emerged from behind a stand of juniper trees, their outlines wavering in the morning heat. The elves ran in unison, so light and fast, their feet raised no dust, and they appeared to fly over the countryside. Nasuwada's scalp prickled. Their speed was both beautiful and unnatural. They reminded her of a pack of predators chasing their prey. She felt the same sense of danger as when she had seen a shurg, a giant wolf, in the Beor Mountains.
Awe-inspiring, aren't they?
Nasuwada started to find Angela next to her. She was annoyed and mystified by how the herbalist had been able to sneak up on her. She wished Elva had warned her of Angela's approach.
How is it you always manage to be present when something interesting is about to occur?
Oh, well, I like to know what's going on. And being there is so much faster than waiting for someone to tell me about it afterward. Besides, people always leave out important pieces of information. Like whether someone's ring finger is longer than their index finger, or whether they have magical shields protecting them, or whether the donkey they are riding happens to have a bald patch in the shape of a rooster's head. Don't you agree?
Nasuwada frowned.
You never reveal your secrets, do you?
Now what good would that do? Everyone would get all excited over some piffle of a spell, and then I'd have to spend hours trying to explain, and in the end King Orin would want to chop off my head, and I would have to fight off half your spellcasters during my escape. It's just not worth the effort, if you ask me.
Your answer hardly inspires confidence, but...
That's because you are too serious, Lady Nightstalker.
But tell me,
Nasuwada persisted,
why would you want to know if someone is riding a donkey with a ball patch shaped like a rooster's head?
Oh, that. Well, the man who owns that particular donkey cheated me at a game of knucklebones out of 3 buttons and a rather interesting shard of enchanted crystal.
Cheated you?
Angela pursed her lips, obviously irked.
The knuckle bones were loaded. I switched them on him, but then he replaced them with a set of his own when I was distracted. I'm still not quite sure how he tricked me.
So you were both cheating?
It was a valuable crystal. Besides, how can you cheat a cheater?
Before Nasuwada could respond, the 6 Nighthawks came pounding out of the camp and took up positions around her. She hid her distaste as the heat and smell of their bodies assailed her. The odor of the 2 Urgles was especially pungent. Then, somewhat to her surprise, the captain of the shift, a burly man with a crooked nose and the name of Garvin, accosted her.
My lady, may I have a word with you in private?
He spoke through close-set teeth as if struggling to contain a great emotion. Angela and Elva looked at Nasuwada for confirmation that she wanted them to withdraw. She nodded, and they began walking west, toward the Jeet River. Once Nasuwada was confident they were out of hearing, she began to speak, but Garvin overrode her, exclaiming,
"Blast it, Lady Nasuwada. You shouldn't have left us as you did."
"Peace, Captain," she replied. "It was a small enough risk, and I felt it was important to be here in time to greet the elves."
Garvin's mail rustled as he struck his leg with a bunched fist.
"A small risk? Not an hour ago you received proof that Galbatorix still has agents hidden among us. He has been able to infiltrate us again and again, and yet you see fit to abandon your escort and go racing through a host of potential assassins. Have you forgotten the attack in Arboron, or how the twins slew your father?"
"Captain Garvin, you go too far."
"I'll go even further if it means ensuring your well-being."
The elves, Nasuwada observed, had halved the distance between them and the camp. Angry, and eager to end the conversation, she said,
"I am not without my own protection, Captain."
Flicking his eyes toward Elva, Garvin said,
"We have suspected as much, lady."
A pause followed, as if he were hoping she would volunteer more information. When she remained silent, he forged onward.
"If you were actually safe, then I was wrong to accuse you of recklessness, and I apologize. Still, safety and the appearance of safety are two different things. For the Nighthawks to be effective, we have to be the smartest, toughest, meanest warriors in the land, and people have to believe that we're the smartest, the toughest, and the meanest. They have to believe that if they try to stab you or shoot you with a crossbow or use magic against you, that we will stop them. If they believe they have about as much chance of killing you as a mouse does a dragon, then they may very well give up the idea as hopeless, and we will have averted an attack without ever having to lift a finger. We cannot fight all your enemies, Lady Nessawada. That would take an army. Even Aragorn couldn't save you if all who want you dead had the courage to act upon their hatred. You might survive 100 attempts on your life, or 1,000, but eventually one would succeed. The only way to keep that from happening is to convince the majority of your enemies that they will never get past the Nighthawks. Our reputation can protect you just as surely as our swords and our armor. It does us no good, then, for people to see you riding off without us. No doubt we looked a right bunch of fools back there, frantically trying to catch up. After all, if you do not respect us, lady, why should anyone else?
Garvin moved closer, dropping his voice.
We will gladly die for you if we must. All we ask in return is that you allow us to perform our duties. It is a small favor, considering. And the day may come when you are grateful we are here. Your other protection is human, and therefore fallible, whatever her arcane powers may be. She has not sworn the same oaths in the ancient language that we of the Nighthawks have. Those sympathies could shift, and you would do well to ponder your fate if she turned against you. The Nighthawks, however, will never betray you. We are yours, Lady Nessawada, fully and completely. So please, let the Nighthawks do what they are supposed to do. Let us protect you.
Initially, Nessawada was indifferent to his arguments, but his eloquence and the clarity of his reasoning impressed her. He was, she thought, a man she might have use for elsewhere.
"I see Jormungandr has surrounded me with warriors as skilled with their tongues as they are with their swords," she said with a smile.
"My lady."
"You are right. I should not have left you and your men behind, and I am sorry. It was careless and inconsiderate. I am still unaccustomed to having guards with me at all hours of the day, and sometimes I forget I cannot move about with the freedom I once did. You have my word of honor, Captain Garvin. It shall not happen again. I do not wish to cripple the Nighthawks any more than you."
"Thank you, my lady."
Nessawada turned back toward the elves, but they were hidden from sight below the bank of a dry stream a quarter of a mile away.
"It strikes me, Garvin, that you may have invented a motto for the Nighthawks a moment ago."
"Did I? If so, I cannot recall."
"You did. The smartest, the toughest, and the meanest, you said. That would be a fine motto, although perhaps without the end. If the other Nighthawks approve of it, you should have Triana translate the phrase into the ancient language, and I will have it inscribed on your shields and embroidered on your standards."
"You are most generous, my lady. When we return to our tents, I shall discuss the matter with Jormungandr and my fellow captains. Only..."
He hesitated then, and guessing at what troubled him, Nessawada said,
"But you are worried that such a motto may be too vulgar for men of your position, and you would prefer something more noble and high-minded, am I right?"
"Exactly, my lady," he said, with a relieved expression.
"It's a valid concern, I suppose. The Nighthawks represent the Varden, and you must interact with notables of every race and rank in the course of your duty. It would be regrettable if you were to convey the wrong impression. Very well. I leave it to you and your compatriots to devise an appropriate motto. I am confident you will do an excellent job."
At that moment the 12 elves emerged from the dry streambed, and Garvan, after murmuring additional thanks, moved a discreet distance from Nasawada. Composing herself for a state visit, Nasawada signalled Angela and Elva to return. When he was still several hundred feet away, the lead elf appeared soot-black from head to toe. At first Nasawada assumed he was dark-skinned like herself and wearing dark attire, but as he drew closer she saw that the elf wore only a loincloth and a braided fabric belt with a small pouch attached. The rest of him was covered with midnight blue fur that glistened with a healthy sheen under the glare of the sun. On average the fur was a quarter inch long, a smooth, flexible armor that mirrored the shape and movement of the underlying muscles, but on his ankles and the undersides of his forearms, it extended a full 2 inches, and between his shoulder blades there was a ruffled mane that stuck out a hand's breadth from his body and tapered down along his back to the base of his spine. Jagged bangs shadowed his brow, and cat-like tufts sprouted from the tips of his pointed ears. But otherwise the fur on his face was so short and flat, only its color betrayed its presence. His eyes were bright yellow. Instead of fingernails, a claw protruded from each of his middle fingers. And as he slowed to a stop before her, Nasawada noticed that a certain odor surrounded him. A salty musk, reminiscent of dry juniper wood, oiled leather, and smoke. It was such a strong smell and so obviously masculine, Nasawada felt her skin go hot and cold and crawl with anticipation, and she blushed and was glad it would not show. The rest of the elves were more as she had expected, of the same general build and complexion as Arya, with short tunics of dusky orange and pine needle green. 6 were men and 6 were women. They all had raven hair, save for 2 of the women whose hair was like starlight. It was impossible to determine their ages, for their faces were smooth and unlined. They were the first elves, besides Arya, that Nasawada had met in person, and she was eager to find out if Arya was representative of her race. Touching his first 2 fingers to his lips, the lead elf bowed, as did his companions, and then twisted his right hand against his chest and said,
"Greetings and felicitations, Nasawada, daughter of Arjehad. Atra esterni onotheldwin."
His accent was more pronounced than Arya's, a lilting cadence that gave his words music.
"Atra duavarinya onovarda," replied Nasawada, as Arya had taught her.
The elf smiled, revealing teeth that were sharper than normal.
"I am Blodgarm, son of Ildrid the Beautiful."
He introduced the other elves in turn before continuing,
"We bring you glad tidings from Queen Islanzadi. Last night our spellcasters succeeded in destroying the gates of Siunon. Even as we speak, our forces advance through the streets toward the tower where Lord Tarrant has barricaded himself. Some few still resist us, but the city has fallen, and soon we shall have complete control over Siunon."
Nasawada's guards and the Varden gathered behind her burst into cheers at the news. She, too, rejoiced at the victory, but then a sense of foreboding and disquiet tempered her celebratory mood as she pictured elves, especially ones as strong as Blodgarm, invading human homes.
"What unearthly forces have I unleashed?" she wondered. "These are glad tidings indeed," she said, "and I am well pleased to hear them. With Siunon captured, we are that much closer to Urubane, and thus to Galbatorix, and the fulfilment of our goals."
In a more private voice, she said,
"I trust that Queen Islanzadi will be gentle with the people of Siunon, with those who have no love for Galbatorix but lack the means or the courage to oppose the Empire."
Queen Islanzadi is both kind and merciful to her subjects, even if they are her unwilling subjects. But if anyone dares oppose us, we shall sweep them aside like dead leaves before an autumn storm.
I would expect nothing less from a race as old and mighty as yours,
Nasawada replied. After satisfying the demands of courtesy with several more polite exchanges of increasing triviality, Nasawada deemed it appropriate to address the reason for the elves' visit. She ordered the assembled crowd to disperse, then said,
Your purpose here, as I understand it, is to protect Aragorn and Saphira. Am I right?
You are, Nasawada Svitkona. And we are aware that Aragorn is still inside the Empire, but that he will return soon.
Are you also aware that Arya left in search of him, and that they are now travelling together?
Blodgarm flicked his ears.
We were informed of that as well. It is unfortunate that they should both be in such danger, but hopefully no harm will befall them.
What do you intend to do then? Will you seek them out and escort them back to the Varden? Or will you stay and wait, and trust that Aragorn and Arya can defend themselves against Galbatorix's minions?
We will remain as your guests, Nasawada, daughter of Ayard. Aragorn and Arya are safe enough as long as they avoid detection. Joining them in the Empire could very well attract unwanted attention. Under the circumstances, it seems best to bide our time, where we can yet do some good. Galbatorix is most likely to strike here at the Varden, and if he does, and if Thorn and Murtagh should reappear, Saphira will need all our help to drive them off.
Nasawada was surprised.
Aragorn said you were among the strongest spellcasters of your race. But do you really have the wherewithal to thwart that accursed pair? Like Galbatorix, they have powers far beyond those of ordinary riders.
With Saphira helping us, yes, we believe that we can match, or overcome, Thorn and Murtagh. We know what the Forsworn were capable of, and while Galbatorix has probably made Thorn and Murtagh stronger than any individual member of the Forsworn, he certainly won't have made them his equals. In that regard, at least, his fear of treachery is to our benefit. Even 3 of the Forsworn could not conquer the 12 of us and a dragon. Therefore we are confident that we can hold our own against all but Galbatorix.
That is heartening. Since Aragorn's defeat at the hands of Murtagh, I have been wondering if we should retreat and hide until Aragorn's strength increases. Your assurances convince me that we are not entirely without hope. We may have no idea how to kill Galbatorix himself, but until we batter down the gates of his citadel in Urubane, or until he chooses to fly out on Shrukan and confront us on the field of battle, nothing shall stop us. She paused. You have given me no reason to distrust you, Blodgarm, but before you enter our camp, I must ask that you allow one of my men to touch each of your minds to confirm that you are actually elves, and not humans Galbatorix has sent here in disguise. It pains me to make such a request, but we have been plagued by spies and traitors, and we dare not take you or anyone else at their word. It is not my intention to cause offence, but war has taught us these precautions are necessary. Surely you, who have ringed the entire leafy expanse of Duweldenvarden with protective spells, can understand my reasons. So I ask, will you agree to this?
Blodgarm's eyes were feral, and his teeth were alarmingly sharp as he said,
For the most part, the trees of Duweldenvarden have needles, not leaves. Test us if you must. But I warn you, whomever you assign the task should take great care he does not delve too deeply into our minds, else he may find himself stripped of his reason. It is perilous for mortals to wander among our thoughts. They can easily become lost and be unable to return to their bodies.
nor are our secrets available for general inspection."
Nasawada understood. The elves would destroy anyone who ventured into forbidden territory.
"Captain Garvin," she said.
Stepping forward, with the expression of a man approaching his doom, Garvin stood opposite Blodgarm, closed his eyes, and frowned intensely as he searched out Blodgarm's consciousness. Nasawada bit the inside of her lip as she watched. When she was a child, a one-legged man by the name of Hargrove had taught her how to conceal her thoughts from telepaths and how to block and divert the stabbing lances of a mental attack. At both those skills, she excelled. And although she had never succeeded at initiating contact with the mind of another, she was thoroughly familiar with the principles involved. She empathized, then, with the difficulty and the delicacy of what Garvin was trying to do. A trial only made harder by the strange nature of the elves. Leaning toward her, Angela whispered,
"You should have had me check the elves. It would have been safer."
"Perhaps," said Nasawada.
Despite all the help the herbalist had given her and the Varden, she still felt uncomfortable relying upon her for official business. For a few moments longer, Garvin continued his efforts, and then his eyes snapped open, and he released his breath in an explosive burst. His neck and face were mottled from the strain, and his pupils were dilated, as if it were night. In contrast, Blodgarm appeared undisturbed. His fur was smooth, his breathing regular, and a faint smile of amusement flickered about the corners of his lips.
"Well?"
asked Nasawada. It seemed to take Garvin a longish while to hear her question. And then the burly captain with the crooked nose said,
"He is not human, my lady. Of that I have no doubt. No doubt whatsoever."
Pleased and disturbed, for there was something uncomfortably remote about his reply, Nasawada said,
"Very well. Proceed."
Thereafter Garvin required less and less time to examine each elf, spending no more than a half dozen seconds on the very last of the group. Nasawada kept a close eye on him throughout the process, and she saw how his fingers became white and bloodless, and the skin at his temples sank into his skull like the eardrums of a frog, and he acquired the languid appearance of a person swimming deep underwater. Having completed his assignment, Garvin returned to his post beside Nasawada. He was, she thought, a changed man. His original determination and fierceness of spirit had faded into the dreamy air of a sleepwalker. And while he looked at her when she asked if he was well, and he answered in an even enough tone, she felt as if his spirit was far away, ambling among dusty, sunlit glades somewhere in the elves' mysterious forest. Nasawada hoped he would soon recover. If he did not, she would ask Aragon or Angela, or perhaps the two of them together, to attend to Garvin. Until such time as his condition improved, she decided that he should no longer serve as an active member of the Nighthawks. Jormungandr would give him something simple to do, so she would not suffer guilt at causing him any further injury, and he might at least have the pleasure of enjoying whatever visions his contact with the elves had left him with. Bitter at her loss, and furious with herself, with the elves, and with Galbatorix and the Empire for making such a sacrifice necessary, she had difficulty maintaining a soft tongue and good manners.
"When you spoke of peril, Blodgarm, you would have done well to mention that even those who return to their bodies do not escape entirely unscathed."
"My lady, I am fine," said Garvin.
His protestation was so weak and ineffectual, hardly anyone noticed, and it only served to strengthen Nasawada's sense of outrage. The fur on Blodgarm's nape rippled and stiffened.
"If I failed to explain myself clearly enough before, then I apologize. However, do not blame us for what has happened. We cannot help our nature. And do not blame yourself either, for we live in an age of suspicion. To allow us to pass unchallenged would have been negligent on your part. It is regrettable that such an unpleasant incident should mar this historic meeting between us, but at least now you may rest easy,
confident that you have established our origins, and that we are what we seem to be, elves of Duweldenvarden. A fresh cloud of his musk drifted over Nasawada, and even though she was hard with anger, her joints weakened, and she was assailed by thoughts of bowers draped in silk, goblets of cherry wine, and the mournful dwarf songs she had often heard echoing through the empty halls of Trondheim. Distracted, she said,
I would Aragorn or Arya were here,
for they could have looked at your minds without fear of losing their sanity. Again she succumbed to the wanton attraction of Blodgarm's odor, imagining what it would feel like to run her hands through his mane. She only returned to herself when Elva pulled on her left arm, forcing her to bend over and place her ear close to the witch-child's mouth. In a low, harsh voice, Elva said,
Whorehound, concentrate upon the taste of whorehound.
Following her advice, Nasawada summoned a memory from the previous year, when she had eaten whorehound candy during one of King Hrothgar's feasts. Just thinking about the acrid flavor of the candy dried out her mouth and counteracted the seductive qualities of Blodgarm's musk. She attempted to conceal her lapse in concentration by saying,
My young companion here is wondering why you look so different from other elves. I must confess to some curiosity on the subject as well. Your appearance is not what we have come to expect from your race. Would you be so kind as to share with us the reason for your more animalistic features?
A shiny ripple flowed through Blodgarm's fur as he shrugged.
This shape pleased me, he said.
Some write poems about the sun and the moon. Others grow flowers or build great structures or compose music.
As much as I appreciate those various art forms, I believe that true beauty only exists in the fang of a wolf, in the pelt of the forest cat, in the eye of an eagle. So I adopted those attributes for myself. In another 100 years I may lose interest in the beasts of the land, and instead decide that the beasts of the sea embody all that is good. And then I will cover myself with scales, transform my hands into fins and my feet into a tail, and I will vanish beneath the surface of the waves, and never again be seen in Alagasia.
If he was jesting, as Nasawada believed, he showed no indication of it. Quite to the contrary, he was so serious, she wondered if he was mocking her.
Most interesting, she said. I hope the urge to become a fish does not strike you in the near future, for we have need of you on dry ground. Of course, if Galbatorix should decide to also enslave the sharks and the rockfish, why then a spellcaster who can breathe underwater may be of some use.
Without warning, the 12 elves filled the air with their clear, bright laughter, and birds for over a mile in every direction burst into song. The sound of their mirth was like water falling on crystal. Nasawada smiled without meaning to, and around her she saw similar expressions on the faces of her guards. Even the 2 Urgals seemed giddy with joy. And when the elves fell silent and the world became mundane again, Nasawada felt the sadness of a fading dream. A film of tears obscured her vision for a clutch of heartbeats, and then that too was gone. Smiling for the first time and thereby presenting a visage both handsome and terrifying, Blodgarm said,
It will be an honor to serve alongside a woman as intelligent, capable and witty as yourself, Lady Nasawada. One of these days, when your duties permit, I would be delighted to teach you our game of runes. You would make a formidable opponent, I'm sure.
The elves' sudden shift in behavior reminded her of a word she had occasionally heard the dwarves use to describe them. Capricious. It had seemed a harmless enough description when she was a girl. It reinforced her concept of the elves as creatures who flitted from one delight to another, like fairies in a garden of flowers. But she now recognized that what the dwarves really meant was, beware, beware, for you never know what an elf will do. She sighed to herself,
depressed by the prospect of having to contend with another group of beings intent on controlling her for their own ends.
Is life always this complicated? She wondered. Or do I bring it upon myself?